Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Terumah. It is not one of the special Shabbatot. It is known as a Hafsakah, a break in the sequence of Shkalim, Zachor, before Purim, Para and Hachodesh after Purim until Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Always spans at least 5 weeks, which means one hafsakah, sometimes 6 weeks, two hafsakot. It can't be done in just four Shabbatot, according to its rules, and this week is a hafsakah. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 4th of Adar, 5770, and even though it's the 6th month of the year counting from Rosh Hashanah, it is technically month number 12 prior to starting the cycle of the months with Nisan coming up in less than a month's time, today being the 4th of Adar. On the secular calendar, February 18th, 2010. I would like to do Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130, and then I'll tell you what I'd like to do. But first, Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shima V'Koli Tichyena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmor Ya Adonai Miya Amod Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Ki Viti Adonai Kivita Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yirachem aleihem, v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'meyafela l'ora, u'mishibud l'geula, Hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv vinomar amen. That, of course, is something I like to do, but here's something I'd like to tell you about. Take down the following website. I guarantee that some of the listeners will want it, but I'll repeat it again later. This is totally by my initiative. This is an unpaid ad, but you'll see for what. www.Levi, L-E-V-I, Sudri, one word, S-U-D-R-I, .com. www.levisudri.com. Here's the story. I have a grandson who's in the first grade of Chorev. He has a teacher who comes in for him maybe twice a week, and one of the tools which he uses to teach is a CD recording called Bekiyut B'Tanach Shirim. Good intensive knowledge in the Tanakh, the Bible, through song. L'shlita B'Sifrei HaTanach V'Dimyotav. The songs are geared to build a grasp of some of the things related to the Bible. The album consists of 14 songs, and I'm going to play one of them for you. The one that I chose is about Kohen, the Kohuna Gedola, the high priesthood of Israel, and I'm doing it because this week in Parshat Terumah we read V'osuli Mikdash V'shachanti B'tocham, build for me or make for me a sanctuary, and I will dwell among them, the people of Israel. And that, of course, brings to mind Kohen Gadol. I could wait for next week, but I'm not going to. If I get a chance, I'll play another song then. The songs are used to teach the kids certain lists related to Tanakh by heart. The 54 weekly Sedras, the books of the Nevi'im, the 12 booklets of Treyasar, the 20 generations from Adam to Noach to Avraham, the Shofetim, the Malchei Yehuda, the kings of Judah, the kings of Israel, who wrote the books of Tanakh, and the track that I have to play now is the one that goes through the chain of the Kohuna Gedola from Aharon HaKohen until the beginning of the time of the Second Temple. It's a song in three parts. The melodies are all familiar. This melody, appropriately, is from Mari Kohen. And the three parts of each of these songs is the full words, then with a few words missing, so someone who has already started learning the list by heart can fill in the blanks, and then just the instrumental, so that you can sing along karaoke style and go through this. As I mentioned, I have a 7-year-old first grader who has all of these down cold. So does his older brother, not yet 10. So does his sister, 5, just turning 5 now. Happy birthday, Roni. And even their 2-year-old little brother has started picking up pieces of these songs even before he could put a whole sentence together. It is incredible, the knowledge that they have. True, through the rote learning of song, but it will come. Go to your average yeshiva student and say, list for me the 10 generations from Adam to Noach. Unless we're dealing with someone who is a Baal Kriya, Baal Kore, who reads the Torah every Shabbat, I doubt anyone will be able to give you that list. You ask my 7-year-old Lavi, my 5-year-old granddaughter, Roni, they will sing you the song, and maybe even list you the generations. This one on the Kohuna Gedola is amazing, and this guy is not the teacher. This Levi Sudri, who did the tapes, the recordings, has several different ones. That's why I gave the website, www.levisudri.com. Because if you're into Jewish education, this is really, really something to check out. It is incredible, because it's not just the knowledge, it is the enthusiasm. You have to hear a whole classroom of Talmidim and Yeshiva singing this song. You have to hear a carload of children of the same family with their parents singing this song. And you'll understand what I mean, and I hope you'll get that infectious from hearing this track on the Kohuna Gedola. I'll play it through. It's not very long, and it's obviously something that has to be played over and over again before you start learning these things, but just a mind-boggling experience and a fantastic idea, and Kol HaKavod to Levi Sudri, and Kol HaKavod to the teacher who uses those, and anyone else who uses these as a tool for teaching.
Emet manedar, mar eko hen gadol. Emet manedar, mar eko hen gadol. Zeto mi bet kochea kodashim zoi shoshelet kehuna gdola Aharon el azar binechas Eli binechas Achitub achimelech אל יתר צדו אחימת עזריה לא אחז יריב יהושפט יהוידע דייתי תהיה יואל יותם אוריה נריה הושעה שלום חלקיה עזריה סליה יבצדת יהושע כהן גדול בתחילת הבית השני אמת מה נהדר מראה כהן גדול אמת מה נהדר מראה כהן גדול בצאתו מבית קודשי הקודשים זוהי שושלת כהונה גדולה אהרון אלעזר אלי פנחס אחיטוב אחימלך אביתר צדוק אחימץ עזריה יואחז יריב יהושפט דיה צדקיה יואל יותם אוריית הושע שלום חלקיה עזריה סריה יבצדת כהן גדול בבחירת
Now, earlier today, I've done something that I used to do a lot in the past and have not done in a while, gave a shiur to the folders. It started out related to the Beit HaMikdash from Parshat Truma, from the Mishkan, and it got off onto other tangents. I think I will put it all into the show because you'll get a feel as to how it works if this were a live broadcast with an audience, which during that recording session it was. And you will see how things take off and hopefully learn from all the different pieces, and then we'll talk more better. Okay, what I'm saying is this. There are people who feel that the Beit HaMikdash had its place a long time ago and it doesn't really fit into the modern world. So what are we asking for when we ask for the restoration of the Beit HaMikdash and its avoda, which we do throughout davening? Furthermore, we seem to have transferred the significance of the Beit HaMikdash into our shuls. In fact, in this week's Torah Tidbits, there's one article that mentions the significance of the shul being a mikdash of today and even the Jewish home being a mikdash of today. Add to that the heart that I described before from Bilavavi. Add to that Rabbi Nachman Kahana's Dvar Torah, which I elaborated on the front cover, which talks about the body of the person being like a Mishkan and a Mikdash. All of this is fine, but it is not a substitute for the rebuilding of a Beit HaMikdash with a Mizbeach, with the offerings as of old, even in our time. Now just, let me say more. V'nishalma parim svatenu, and our lips have replaced the bulls, that's the pasuk, which is a major concept of tefillah. What is davening? Davening is a lot of other things, but it is also a replacement of korbanot on a mizbeach. As the pasuk says, v'nishalma unishalma parim svatenu. Now, that pasuk is not recent. That's in the Navi Yeshayahu. And he was talking about post Churban Bayit Rishon. So you had a generation or two of people who remember, or their parents or grandparents remembered Avoda and the Beit HaMikdash. And they needed something of, what are we going to do now that we don't have a Beit HaMikdash and we're exiled, we're all lost. No, you're not all lost, because, among other things, v'nishalma parim svatenu. And I believe the shul picked up its significance, the table, the dining table in one's home, as being shulchan domel mizbeach. All of that was, the Beit HaMikdash once filled a very, very central part of focus of Jewish spiritual energy and activity. And when it was destroyed, that activity should not have dissipated, and it was channeled in different directions. Does this mean that we didn't daven during the time of the Beit HaMikdash? We did. Davening predates the Mikdash. Davening has always been there since the time of the Avot. And it picked up an extra function. It would be something, lahavdil, just to give you a feeble analogy, if you wrote a birthday card to your mother, and someone reminds you that it's Mother's Day, and you can't go out and get another card, so you will add to the birthday card, and also Happy Mother's Day. That's what davening was always there. That's like the birthday card in this feeble attempt at an analogy. And the added dimension of it replacing korbanot came along rather than creating something new. So we read in davening the passages of korbanot. We have a second Torah on Chagim with a Musaf laning. And we daven Musaf, same reason. In fact, Shacharit, Mincha, and Ma'ariv have always been there. Musaf is specifically a creation to represent the Korbanot. There was no Korban Musaf in ancient times. This came about when we commemorate the Beit HaMikdash, which is no longer standing. Will we daven Musaf with a third Beit HaMikdash? Certainly it'll be changed. The text will be changed. Maybe we won't altogether. I don't know. That's not the point. My point is that there are aspects of the Mikdash that people are self-conscious about or embarrassed about, because how are they going to tell their friends and neighbors who aren't Jewish that there's going to be a Beit HaMikdash? So we've grown so accustomed to not having it, and so accustomed to all of these things that commemorate it, and we sing the song Yibane HaMikdash Ir Tzion Tamaleh with fervor, and we dance around, and somehow isn't that enough? It always reminds me of that story, probably a made-up story, about a family seder someplace in New York, where they were singing Lashana Habab Yerushalayim, and the woman of the house started to cry. And her husband said, "Why are you crying?" And she answered, "Because I don't want to be in Yerushalayim next year. I want to be here." And the husband said, "Don't worry, it's only a song." Oh. And that's a problem. That's a problem. There really needs to be a sincere tzfiyah, looking forward to and longing for the Beit HaMikdash. Now, again, we have been very psychologically defensive against falling apart without the Beit HaMikdash. Exile could be, that's it, that's the end. Rejection by God, kicked out of Eretz Yisrael, and we have nothing. So we have done tremendous things in keeping our Judaism alive and well throughout our Galut, to the point where many people feel, well, this is it. I read about the Korbanot, I have self-sacrifice for Jewish causes. That's the modern equivalent of a sacrifice. And the thought of Korbanot scares some people. I don't know how to take that feeling away. I have a strong feeling that we have been put on hold as far as these things are concerned, and that, let's take for example the use of animals in our daily life. We eat the meat of animals, except for veggies. We wear the leather products of animals, and we have, some of us, pets of animals, and some of us raise animals, not us necessarily, and sell them and ride them, and that's all fine, except for Karen and the eating part of it. Hold that thought. We'll be right back after station identification or whatever else Israel National Radio does at this point, and we'll pick up the thread of the shear to the folders shortly. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Teruma. We were talking about the Mishkan, the Beit HaMikdash, and whatever tangents we went off onto. And here's more of that. When we're finished, we will talk some more. Where do we have permission to use the animal world the way we do? That which originally gives us that permission is Korbanot. The fact that when Noach came out of the Teva and he offered sacrifices of animals to God, that's when God said, human beings, you need not be vegetarians anymore. You may eat the meat of animals provided you kill the animal first. For the Jew, it's more than that. It's ritual slaughter, shchita, and all kind of rules, and which animals we're allowed to eat and which we're not allowed to eat. But essentially, it was Noach's initiative that opened the permission properly for our dominance, let's say, of nature. Obviously, what I'm saying is oversimplified, and if you were more polite, you probably could argue with me on it. But probably you're afraid that I'm recording this anyway, so you don't want to argue. But I believe that there's something there, because this is echoed in the Torah, in Parshat, Vayikra, and Tzav, and the first half of Shmini, which deals with Korbanot. And in the second half of Shmini, we finally get to, and these are the animals among the mammals you may eat, those that have split hoof and chew their cud, and you're not allowed to eat the Arnevet, the Gamal, and the Shafan, because they do chew their cud, but they don't have split hoof, nor the Chazir, the pig, the swine, the hog, because they have split hoof and they don't chew their cud. And these are the birds you're not allowed to eat, and these are the fish you're allowed to eat. Those, but all of that comes after 2.5 sedras of the whole business with korbanot, communal korbanot, private korbanot, required korbanot, optional korbanot. I believe, as if to say, that is where if you put God first in this picture and you follow His requirements, then you're able to go further than that. Now, I don't know how to talk to a person who says, I don't eat meat, I don't wear leather, I don't have a pet, and I don't benefit from animals, because I believe we're all equal creatures in this world. Alright, so I don't have a good argument for that. People who don't eat meat because of health reasons, I certainly understand that. People who don't eat meat because they don't even like the idea of killing an animal, to them I ask the question, in the time of the next Beit HaMikdash, will you eat the one tiny portion of meat that is required of every Jew each year? And that is a kazayit of Korban Pesach, roast lamb. Not talking about all the other korbanot. You want to bypass them? You're pretty much able to do that unless you're a Kohen. If the person says to me, of course I'll eat the kazayit of Korban Pesach because it's required, then he's putting his vegetarianism second to his Judaism, and that's beseder. That's okay. A person who told me, and I heard it with my own ears, who said to me, quote, God will have to forgive me, but I wouldn't even eat the kazayit of Korban Pesach. That person, in my opinion, is close to being an idol worshiper. The idolatry is called vegetarianism. Vegetarianism is okay unless it becomes an idolatry. And I think that's an expression of it. The other hang-up I have with vegetarians is the quote that I saw from one of the founders of Jewish Vegetarian Society, that eating meat is the same as cannibalism. And when you say that, you lose me on your side. If you want to say animals are mistreated in the production of food, that I will help you fight. And I've told the story before. I stopped eating veal a long time ago. Just veal. I eat everything else. Well, not now. I stopped eating veal because I saw a program on television about the production of veal. And they described how the calves are taken away from their mothers at 3 days of age. When I heard that, it immediately reminded me of the Torah's requirement for a korban of shivat yamim. 7 days it stays with its mother, and only from the eighth day you're allowed to take it. And animal behaviorists described how dependent a calf is at its very early age on the mother. And they keep these. Now, this is maybe not so much in Israel. I don't know how they do veal, but in the United States at that time that I saw this documentary, they would keep the calves in barns, in isolated pens, which restricted their movement, in 24-hour-a-day darkness, in order to make them anemic, in order that their meat will be softer. So you don't have to use A1 tenderizer or whatever. And then at age 110 days, they're slaughtered. They compared this with the free-roaming calves in the pastures and described how frequently they suckle from their mother even when they don't need nourishment and the contact and all of that. And I said, no more veal. When I told this to a vegetarian, he said to me, yeah, do you know what they do to chickens? I said, don't tell me. I don't want to know. It's like that old line about, this goes back many years, I've been reading so much about the hazard to health of smoking, that you're giving up smoking? No, I'm giving up reading. You know? that was the old line. So here, don't tell me what they do. And sure enough, when I went and saw what they do with chickens in order to increase egg laying production, it turned me off of chicken for a couple of weeks. You know, but and how they brutalize potatoes, it's just something something awful. Which just reminds me of that old thing. This is not really on the topic, but it's an illustration of the difference in our attitude. Story about the biology professor who came, first lecture, full auditorium of students, goes up to the podium, everyone gets quiet. He doesn't say anything, but he reaches into an inside pocket and pulls out a large bundle of celery and puts it on the podium, reaches into another pocket and pulls out a cleaver and proceeds to chop, chop, chop up the celery into little bits and then pushes it off the podium, and everybody's watching and nobody's saying anything and he's not saying anything. He reaches into a pocket and pulls out a little white mouse. And he has it run up his arm and to his shoulder and come back down. He puts it down, lifts up the cleaver, and there's a collective gasp from the audience. He said, "The fact that not one of you objected when I brutalized that celery shows me that you understand there's a difference between the plant world and the animal world." And that was his point. And by the way, I've always liked that story, whether it's actually true or not, it doesn't matter. I've always liked the story because it fits into our hashkafa, and I'll show you where. I have a sefer on Tsa'ar Balei Chaim, avoiding of cruelty to animals. And the sefer, first chapter is, these are the mitzvot in the Torah from which our sages derive the concept of avoiding cruelty to animal. Things like not muzzling an animal when it's working with food, helping someone unload a beast of burden that's overloaded, not harnessing two incompatible animals together to pull a plow. Those are the core mitzvot which reflect cruelty to animals if you don't do them, kindness to animals if you keep them, and they're the basis of the whole structure of kindness to animals. Then the second chapter is, here are other mitzvot that input into the whole picture, and one of them was shatnez, the prohibition of wearing wool and linen together. So my first reaction is, what is this doing in cruelty to animals? Because wool, yeah, comes from animals, linen comes from a plant. And he says that's the point. The commentary said there that by virtue of the following knowledge, we have God's permission, so to speak, to take fibers from the plant world. And we have God's permission to take fibers from the animal world. Chief among the fibers of the plant world at the time was linen. Today, maybe it's a cotton or the rayon plant, which is very famous, you know, the polyester plants, you know, of the world. Linen, and the chief fiber among the animal kingdom was wool. Both of them significant in this week's Sedra. Huh. So it's not really a tangent. We're back to this week's Sedra. This week's Sedra mentions the wool and the linen that was collected for the fashioning of the Mishkan, the covering of the Mishkan, the parochet and the masach, and next week we'll have in the garments of the Kohen. The point there is one fiber from the animal world, one fiber from the plant world, the chief among them, combined is a demonstration of our human mastery and dominance over nature. We use animals, we use plants, and to our pleasure or whatever, we take fibers from both and we mix them to arraign ourselves. Comes the Torah and says, here is a small token limit. The Kohen Gadol in the Beit HaMikdash, his garments will contain wool and linen together. But you are not allowed to wear a garment of linen and wool. You want to wear wool and cotton? No problem. You want to make a tapestry to hang on your wall of wool and linen? No problem. You want to sew wool and linen sweaters for non-Jews? No problem. But you and I cannot wear a garment of wool and linen, token, a token reminder that there is a difference between where you get the linen and where you get the wool. I saw a movie, the recorder for some reason conked off exactly at that point, so let me finish the thought. I was referring to a movie that I have seen. I don't remember the name. It took place in Australia. And one of the scenes was a competition between sheep shearing in the different stations to see who could produce the most wool in a 24-hour period. The images of the way the shearers handled the sheep during the shearing immediately struck a note in my mind as not halachic, meaning no concern for tzar balei chayim, shearing the sheep right down to the skin to increase the yield of the wool, even though you leave the sheep very vulnerable to disease and infection, which is not the normal way to do it, even for economic reasons. And the very rough handling of the sheep during the shearing, because you're concerned with speed and production and not with care for the animal. I think that to me was an illustration of the difference between the way we have to react and interrelate and feel about the animal kingdom that we share this planet with. I believe that God created the human being similar to other mammals on purpose. We could have been totally different. What differentiates us is our power of reasoning and our power of speech and many other qualities that we have. But you do not have on that list distinctions of anatomical features. Yes, our ears are not the same as animal ears, and theirs are not the same as each other anyway. That's not the point. The point is that we are close enough to the animal world for us to relate to it in a very positive way and a very constructive way. And I think that's part of the message of Shatnez, the separation of wool and linen, to say, as if God says, wait, there is a difference between the way that you will take the fiber from the flax plant and the way you take the fiber from a living and breathing sheep. And that's all part of the picture. That was pretty much the end of the shear to the folders. As you noticed, I got off on tangents. It did not stay on the track of the Asuli Mikdash v'Shachanti B'Tocham. I joked when I said that I was back on the track because Tchelet Argaman and Tolaat Shani are three different dyed wools, and they were among the materials collected for the construction and fashioning of the Mishkan, as well as Sheish linen and Sheish Moshezar, which is a special way of preparing the linen for various uses in the Mishkan. So it in some way related to Truma, but let's see if I can put a picture on Truma. Unlike last week's Sedra of Mishpatim, with 53 mitzvot out of 613, in Truma we find only 3 mitzvot. And all 3 mitzvot relate to the Mikdash, to the sanctuary, to the Mishkan, the temporary sanctuary, also known in English as tabernacles, and they are to make such a sanctuary, and then one prohibition, rather, that is a small detail, nonetheless singled out as a prohibition among the 365 lo ta'aseh, lavin, negative commandments in the Torah, and that is the prohibition of removing the carrying rods of the aron from the rings that are welded onto the sides of the aron, ever. The carrying poles are put in. They are not just meant for carrying. They are meant to stay there forever and forever. And the prohibition to remove them is counted as a separate one of the 613 mitzvot. The other mitzvah from Truma is the mitzvat aseh, the positive command of putting the lechem hapanim, known in English as the showbread, the weekly 12 loaves, which were halachic matzah, by the way, not regular bread, on the shulchan, the shelves of the shulchan, each Shabbat. They were baked on Friday, and they were distributed when they were removed and replaced by the new weeks. The previous week, according to our tradition, a miracle occurred, and it did not get stale, and it was distributed among the Kohanim who were on duty at the time. The first mitzvah of V'osu li mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham, make for me a sanctuary, this is a very, very wide, encompassing command. Rambam, for example, is very emphatic, not just in his treatment of this mitzvah, but he includes it in one of his 14 principles called Shorashim, by which he will count the mitzvot, that when you have mitzvot, which are commands, that is, which are details of a more all-encompassing mitzvah, you only count the encompassing mitzvah and not the details as separate commands. So, even though the Torah uses that language, va'asu aron atzei shitim, make an ark, and do this to it, make a gold lid and fashion the kruvim from it, all of that is part of the Osuli Mikdash V'Shachanti B'Tocham. To make a menorah, you look at the language in the Torah. If you were to be running a computer analysis of the Torah and flagging key words in order to extract a list of mitzvot from the Torah, it would come out. You would get a flag on making the menorah and making the shulchan and making the mizbeach, and all the different details are all posed in the form of command. But Rambam's rule is we are only going to count making the mikdash and everything in it among the 613 mitzvot, and all of the detail are exactly that. They are detail, even though they have the language of a command. Interestingly, Ramban, Nachmanides, agrees pretty much with the Rambam, with the exception of the Aron. He claims that the Holy Ark, which held the tablets, as well as, according to some people, the original first Sefer Torah, written by Moshe Rabbeinu, some say it was on a shelf on the side of the Aron, some say it was inside the Aron, with the Luchot, and by the way, with the Shivrei Luchot HaRishonot, with the Rishonim, of the first tablets which were broken by Moshe Rabbeinu when he saw the people dancing around the golden calf, but that we'll discuss in a few weeks' time from now. The Ramban, Nachmanides, counts that as a separate command. And Rambam, Maimonides, does not. He includes making of the Oron as part of the making of the Mikdash. Ramban separates and singles out the Oron. It is, after all, a very unique feature of the Beit HaMikdash, the sole occupant of Kodshe Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies, from which, between the Kruvim, on top of the lid of the Aron, emanated God's voice in communication with Moshe and through Moshe to all of the people. So it was a very special thing, and especially since the Torah describes the command to make the Aron, the actual making of the Aron before the Mishkan itself was made to house the Aron, even though the Shulchan and the Menorah are like that. Also, Nachmanides, singles out the Aron for that kind of honor. That's about it for this Shabbat. I hope that even though we went off on tangents, you got something out of the show. And I wish you all a continued good month of Adar. Certainly a Shabbat Shalom. The song that we started the first part with was Mishenichnas Adar, when Adar enters Marbim Besimcha, we increase the level of joy. The second half of the show was introduced with a little bit of V'nahafochu, referring to the month as being that month in which the fate of the Jewish people was turned upside down. It looked bad with Haman's plot, and we ended up prevailing over our enemies. It is always the hope and prayer of the Jewish people that the victories and the miracles and God's smile upon us at such events like the Purim story will happen in our own time as well. We do not lack enemies of the Jewish people, and we are hoping for the same v'nahafochu. May we prevail over all of our enemies for our own benefit and the sake of the entire world. L'hishtameah.